Second anniversary yesterday. 2 years on, anyone sensible, and there are very few people that aren't sensible looking at the horrendous situation in Ukraine, will recognize that there's a stalemate. Zelensky doesn't like the word, but I think it accurately describes the situation. That's in spite of Bakhmut and Avdiivka and inching Russian advances. But in reality, what we have is 1,000 kilometers of trenches, defense works on both sides. And in essence, and I don't want to push my luck and say this will continue throughout 2024, but it could easily a situation of where there are no dramatic breakthroughs of any sort. In other words, we've gone from the early stages of this war, what Putin calls a special military operation, where we had Russian tanks and forces marching on the Ukrainian capital. Either to surround it or to get in there and take it and force a surrender or negotiations, who knows what. We've gone from a situation of where it's now clear that having made advances in the east and in the south last year, and really in the autumn of the previous year, Russia made a strategic withdrawal. And I think that would be an accurate description. I do remember, Wagner and other sort of bellicose Russians talking about the chief of staff and the high command being cowards and how they should be sent to the front line to fight with a rifle, but bare feet. Because giving up territory was such a cowardly thing to do. But looking at things now, it's clear that they withdrew to defensible positions. And indeed, I haven't seen evidence for this, but it's conceivable, surely, that they withdrew to prearranged defensive positions. And certainly, once I saw the satellite images, I know I keep saying it, but it's sort of seared in my brain. These satellite images pu published by the Financial Times, the BBC, and could have been the Washington Post, but I'm not going to swear on it. But you look at these satellite pictures of the whole of the border and the front line. Between Ukrainian forces and Russian forces. And in my estimate, okay, I'm an armchair general, but in my estimate, there was going to be no breakthrough. I just couldn't conceive how Ukraine, given the relative strengths on both sides, was going to make a breakthrough. So, yes, we heard stuff, didn't we, about Leopard 2s and I don't know, British Challenger 2 tanks, Abrahams coming around the corner, lots of Bradley fighting vehicles. And this supposedly would allow a Ukrainian breakthrough. And there was talk of Ukrainian troops paddling in the warm waters of the Black Sea. As I said, I was not only not convinced of that, I was convinced that that just wasn't going to happen. And my understanding is that apart from one breach in the south, and that is of the first line of defense, there's been no breakthrough in the much vaunted spring offensive that actually, of course, came in the summer. And indeed, what we saw, as surely you would expect, is as Ukrainian armor advanced on Russian lines, there was slaughter. And we saw drones, artillery take out all these new tanks and fighting vehicles. We saw Ukraine reduced to actually sending in individuals at night to deal with the minefields, because what Russian defences consisted of all the way along the front line, all the way up the border, is first of all, tank traps. I don't know how deep, I don't know how wide, but tank traps, followed by dragon's teeth. So if you do have a bridge put over, these tanks come across these concrete pyramid-shaped obstacles, three lines of them. And before you arrive at Russian trenches with Russian soldiers, armor and troops will have to cross, and we know now, an incredibly tightly packed minefield. So, okay, they come across the first trench that is manned by Russian soldiers. Behind that, the Russians installed howitzer positions, artillery positions, would have channeled Ukrainian forces into a killing zone. If they lost that, they had two lines of similar defenses to fall back on. So my understanding is that in one particular area, Ukrainian forces did manage to get to that first trench. But of course, what happened to them was that they were subject to bombardment by artillery, intense bombardment. So there they were. They were crouching in those trenches that they'd taken. They were in no position whatsoever to carry on to tackle the next two lines of defence, let alone reach the warm waters of the Black Sea. So all the equipment, all the planning came to naught with the first contact with the enemy. So I think that I think it's official now. I don't think there's anything controversial in saying it. The Ukrainian summer offensive failed, and it failed completely, spectacularly. Okay. So what about the other side? Well, we are told, and I take it, you know, because there are so many reports confirming it, that it's true that Russia has a substantial advantage when it comes to artillery and the production and use of artillery shells. And this isn't just North Korean equipment that is coming, you know, via the Trans-Siberian Railway. You know, Russian industry at the moment produces substantially more in the way of artillery shells than Europe and the United States in total. And of course, that's going to the front line, and Ukrainian sources and Western sources, presumably echoing Ukrainian sources, talk of a Russian advantage of either 5-1, that's one figure I've read, or 10-1. Now that matters because what we have at present much closer resembles World War One, and I'm talking, of course, about the Western Front, what we would call the Western Front, than World War Two, or Afghanistan, or Vietnam, or let alone you know, the Gulf War One or Gulf War Two. It's a static front. It's a front that's fought over by infantry, that you still need boots on the ground in these wars, fought over with artillery. Artillery is used to take ground, but it's also used to keep ground. In other words, the Ukrainians, in order to repel Russian forces, need artillery, need bombardment after bombardment. But it's also true the other way around. Without artillery, you aren't going to take anything. And without artillery, you aren't going to hold anything. And of course, the novel feature of this war is crucially drones. You could add in missiles, You could add in, glide bombs, but the real big difference is drones. And I must admit that when I first heard the figures, I was stunned. Ukraine uses on average 40,000 drones a month. And again, I have to confess, when I first heard that Russia was importing these sort of delta-shaped kamikaze drones from Iran, I somewhat sneered at them because these are made from parts that are available almost from your average electric shop. I don't know how much chips they've got from vacuum cleaners or whatever else we have chips in nowadays, but they are cheap. They're not reusable. As I said, they are kamikaze, but they are used en masse. And it's suicide drones that can deliver a pretty sizable punch, plus drones that can deliver the equivalent explosive power of a hand grenade and can watch over and hover over the enemy lines that has made the difference in this war. And it's notable in terms of recent announcements. The United States, when it's looking at this war and looking at how its equipment is faring and how its tactics are faring, how it's reevaluating future wars. So, for example, the Biden administration has actually cancelled a whole tranche in terms of orders of perhaps the most sophisticated fighter plane on the planet, certainly one of the most expensive fighter planes on the planet, and that's the F-35, the one that at the moment flies off, I think, yes, it does, from the two aircraft carriers in the British Navy, but also is, it's a stealth aircraft, it's a fifth generation aircraft, it's packed full of electronics, it can avoid radar. It can do all sorts of fantastic things, but they've cancelled them because would you put, into the field, would you put over Russian-held territory an F-35? Well, I wouldn't. They're too expensive. The training needed to man such an aircraft will take not months, but I would guess at least several years. Before you become fully proficient using these aircraft. And of course, these aircraft, while they can avoid radar, will still be vulnerable from ground attack in terms of cheap missiles. So, precisely, maybe you'd use these aircraft against the Houthis in Yemen, but you wouldn't use them. Against the Russians. And all the stuff that we heard, as I said, about the tanks, that's gone out of the window. But also, I argued from the beginning, all the stuff, all the agitation around F-16s that Ukraine wanted to get its hands on, these are fourth generation fighter aircraft. They're incredibly, deadly. They're highly maneuverable. But what you'd use them for isn't in dogfights. That's no longer on the agenda. What you'd use such aircraft for nowadays is launch something the equivalent of either a guided missile or a glider bomb. And a glider bomb has the great advantage of being massively cheaper. Than a cruise missile. So that's what exists. So it's World War One plus drones. And so yeah, the tank I think has gone the way of the cavalry. And the only how should you put it, significant victory, I think, and okay, it's qualified, but I think we can call it that. That Ukraine has scored really has been in the Black Sea. And Ukraine, not because of its navy, but because of its underwater drones, its aerial drones, and its British French guided missiles, cruise missiles, has managed to take out ship after ship of the Russian Navy and forced the Russian Navy to shift to the east. And my conclusion from that is that it's not only fixed wing and, for that matter, helicopters that have been sent the way of the cavalry. I also think that, in terms of navies, certainly aircraft carriers, but maybe it goes further down the pecking order, ships, maybe they've gone the way of the old battleship of World War I, which was redundant by the time World War II came along, and we were into the era of air warfare, not least with aircraft carriers. How a Queen Elizabeth II cost of something like £7 billion, and that's excluding the F-35s that it is the launch pad for. I mean, surely these are now incredibly vulnerable to underwater drones, to airborne drones, to missiles, because of course they're not just going to send off when it comes to the Chinese or the Russians. They're not going to send one or two drones against an aircraft carrier, which is, by the way, of course, protected by its own flotilla of defense ships. Missiles would be going up, all manner of firepower would be there to protect it. But surely what would be sent against it would be swarms of drones, swarms, hundreds and hundreds of drones, hundreds of missiles. And so, yeah, these ships can knock down one, two, three, four, five, six, seven drones easily. But 100, I'm extremely skeptical. So I think that it's been a revolution in warfare, and much of the high-tech equipment that armies and air forces and navies were equipping themselves with, I think now are white elephants. And I would include in that the highly sophisticated drones that the United States was using in Afghanistan, drones that would hover above the enemy and then would launch a missile and then head back to base to be reequipped. They are too expensive, these Iranian style drones, and drones that you can buy off the shelf are far more effective. They cost thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. So you can use many more of them than you can this highly expensive, highly sophisticated kit. Okay, so let's come to a potential game changer. And that is, of course, if Congress refuses the Biden administration $60 billion package, $60 billion package to Ukraine. If Ukraine doesn't get the US equipment, doesn't get the US shells, can Europe fill the vacuum? Not in the same way, that's for sure. And then, of course, we have the possibility, I'd say quite a distinct possibility, and I'll come to that, of Biden actually being a one-term president and not being replaced by another successful Democrat candidate for November, but of course Donald Trump. And as I said, we'll come to Donald Trump in a little while. Okay, just an underlying point. Let's just get it clear. If you just read the Western press, if you just looked at Western TV, if you just looked at West, listened to Western radio, if you just listened to the social imperialist so-called left, you would think that this war simply began 2 years ago bar one day. And I think that would be a profound mistake. For our purposes, we don't need to go back to medieval Rus, as Putin does and did with, remember the Tucker Carlson interview, or was it the Tucker Carlson Donald Trump lecture? 2 hours, 5 minutes. It was pretty boring stuff. But no, we don't need to go back to medieval times. But I think for our purposes, to understand what's going on in Ukraine now, we do need to go back to 89, 91, and the collapse of bureaucratic socialism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and how not only Russia was impoverished, it was Ukraine that was impoverished to a degree that makes, you know, the average Russian citizen look positively affluent. In Russia, the average male life expectancy tumbled. I think it was over a decade was lost. In Ukraine, it was worse. In Ukraine, more industry closed. In Ukraine, more people were made unemployed. More people turned to drugs and alcohol. There was more examples of early death. And we also need to go back to what I will call, and I think it needs to be called, the Maidan coup. It wasn't a revolution. It was a coloured revolution, but it was carried out by small forces, right wing. You can call them fascist, I would, in terms of many of the organizations. I'm much less certain when it comes to calling them Nazi. These are Ukrainian fascists of the sort of Bandera variety. Either way, this was something that was done with the complicity, with the direction of the CIA. The CIA in America, the State Department knew what it was doing. It was trying to lever Ukraine out of, maybe it's an exaggeration to call it the Russian sphere of influence, but from Russian influence, I don't think it was in the sphere of Russian influence. Either way, they wanted to lever it away towards NATO, towards the EU. And of course, what they got as a result of that, I don't know if that was part of the calculation, but surely there would have been voices, you know, in the Pentagon advising that, look, if you do that, or if we do that, what's Putin going to do about Crimea, about their Black Sea fleet, which gives them access to the Mediterranean? Are they going to be willing to sacrifice this historic port? And remember, Crimea was given away to Ukraine by Khrushchev as some rather strange gesture. The majority of the people there are not only Russian speaking, they identify themselves as Russian. And then you have the East, again, something that was the result of territorial calculation, this time by the Bolsheviks, by Lenin, Stalin, his minister of nationalities, to get some Russians into Ukraine to sort of, how should we put it, to temper any possibility of Russian, Ukrainian separatism or whatever. Either way, yes, you would look at that. But for me, it's 1989, 91, 2014. And really what we've had is a 10-year war, because of course Putin ordered the seizure of Crimea, a referendum, you know, okay, 90% or whatever the figure was. You know, I don't really see why we would particularly dispute the figure. It might have been fixed, but hey, I can easily go along with it. When it came to the figures in Donbass, that's a different question, because Donbass was never united. Nonetheless, in the Russian held areas, and we're talking about, first of all, separatist areas now incorporated in to Mother Russia, as clearly in response to Ukrainian chauvinism, with statues going up to this fascist collaborator, you know, with the Nazis in World War II, with stamps, bridges, named after him, with the Russian language being discriminated against. It's hardly surprising that you would get a Russian reaction to that, with the killing, with the persecution of Russian people. Okay, and also, and this is the final point directly on Ukraine, while Donald Trump boasts that he could solve the Ukraine war within 48 hours, and I believe him because we all know what Russia wants ish. It wants Donbass, maybe some joint sovereignty arrangement. I don't know. It could be negotiated with. It certainly wants Crimea or access to Sevastopol, the historic Black Sea, the base of the Black Sea fleet. Who knows what else that could be conceded. On the other hand, maybe it isn't so simple. After all, one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans are agreed on in Congress in Washington is that China is the only strategic full spectrum challenger to US hegemony. So both sides in Washington are agreed that China is the main target. And maybe Donald Trump could prize Russia away from its unconditional friendship, no ends barred, and all the rest of it, friendship with China. Maybe. On the other hand, precisely because of this war, Russia and China, but crucially, Russia has become more and more integrated in with China in terms of its fossil fuel economy, in terms of its supply lines, in terms of its military, and in terms of global diplomacy. So maybe even, Mr. Trump, the deal maker, couldn't actually persuade Putin that he can get enough in order to shift him from the Chinese orbit into the American orbit. We don't know. I certainly don't know. All I'm really trying to indicate is we shouldn't understand this war as simply an act of horrendous Russian aggression that began 2 years ago out of the blue. In the same way, you cannot understand, you shouldn't try to understand what happened in southern Israel on October the 7th as just a load of mad Hamas fighters determined to kill as many young Jewish people as possible. It didn't come out of nowhere. At the very least, you would go back to 48 and the Declaration of Independence, 47, the civil war in Palestine, but surely you'd have to go back to the whole colonial settler project and the Balfour Declaration and the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire by Anglo-French imperialism. That's how you need to understand wars. You need to understand wars specifically, yes, but you crucially can only properly understand them in historic terms. And if you ignore the history, you understand nothing. Okay, Trump. To me, not say anything original here, he seems on course in the same way that Labour Party in Britain seems on course to win the general election. He's just won South Carolina. What was the margin? 58% to 30%. There was another candidate. It was Mr. Whatever his name is. I've forgotten it already. Same one as last time. But as I say, the margin was convincing. And what makes it sort of particularly significant, of course, is that his main opponent, only serious opponent, Nikki Haley, she was the governor there. And she spent, in terms of this campaign on her home turf, 12 times as much as Donald Trump. So Donald Trump, my understanding is, spent a million, not very much in American terms, $1 million on this campaign. She, as you know already, spent 12. Where are the $12 million from? In the main, my understanding is trusts, foundations, mega rich individuals who don't want Trump. In other words, there are divisions clearly in the US ruling class. And it's for that reason, when I'm looking at the opinion polls, which put Trump on course to win the Republican nomination, and then opinion polls say that Donald Trump, compared with Joe Biden, is ahead in the popular poll. It's why me, you, anyone would say that chances are Donald Trump will win in November. Why? Because we have an electoral system that's indirect, that's got an inbuilt advantage to Republicans. So if a Republican is out ahead in the popular poll, that means when it comes to the electoral college, they'll be way out in front. And so therefore, precisely, I haven't got a clue what's going to happen. But if there was some sort of military intervention, if there was some sort of intervention by the FBI, CIA, I don't know. The arrest of Donald Trump, not for fraud, but for treason, I don't know. But it's something like that, at least, is conceivable. And therefore, a coup against democracy in order to save democracy, I think, is thinkable. And indeed, it's only in the last week or so I've read mainstream commentators making the point. And I don't think they've been listening to Jack Conrad or reading the Weekly Worker to come to such a speculative possibility. I think it's a real possibility. What then happens in terms of the Western world and its democratic ideology that it's paraded, I would have thought, in America for a long time, but certainly in terms of the West more generally, since, how should I put it, since the failure of the October Revolution to take the majority of the population with it. And you could put that at in, you know, late 1917, we can have an argument about it. But at some point, what you get is official communism, call it whatever you will. And I include Lenin in this, but above all, Trotsky, giving up the argument about democracy and handing that weapon to the so-called West. So even when you didn't have universal suffrage in countries like Britain, France, they were talking the language of democracy against the Soviet Union. And, you know, we had comrades like Trotsky and terrorism and communism, you know, basking in the glory of dictatorship used in the modern way, not the classic Marxist or Roman fashion. Either way, I think the so-called West is going towards some sort of crisis. And we need to understand the Ukraine war, the conflict with China as part of that. I personally don't see any quick Ukrainian collapse. I don't underestimate the power of the United States or Western Europe, Japan, and all the rest of it. It's still overwhelmingly the dominant economic and military power on the earth, but clearly it's in decline. And clearly there's a possibility of an enormous ideological crisis for it. Okay, meanwhile, we have in the West, as you all know, but it is worthwhile saying, trying to soften up the population to accept higher arms spending. So the Tories, I presume, will increase arms spending in this year's budget. Other countries are under pressure to do so. We have the ideological side of that with talk of World War III, not only Russia, but China. We have all the talk of civilian armies, conscript armies. Reality, what is being posed, in my view, this is putting it starkly, is guns or butter. And the population, they're trying to win the population to sort of vote for guns. Really what they're trying to persuade them of is of course, austerity, pay restraint. i.e. actually falling real incomes, falling real living standards. But that's going to be done in a patriotic way. It's going to be done, at least at the moment, in defense of democracy and all of that stuff. And what we need to make the point about this is that the social imperialists need to take their share of responsibility for this. If they go, you know, out on the streets of London and other cities and shout, at least as that's what they've been doing in London, arm, arm, arm Ukraine, what they're shouting for in reality is guns, not butter. They need to take responsibility for the Tories' anti-trade union laws, of the Tories cutting the real pay of junior doctors, forcing down the real pay, the take-home pay of RMT workers. So in terms of the public sector unions, we have the public service union, PSC, or is it the PCS? PCS, trying to get the union right. Mark Sawatka, the general secretary of, for the moment, I think he hasn't retired yet. Either way, this is one of the unions, one of the few unions, and I think the other union is ASLEF, that's affiliated to the ghastly Ukraine solidarity campaign run by Chris Ford. And as we've illustrated in the Weekly Worker, this campaign has its origins in CIA. No exaggeration, no, you know, leftist hysteria about this story. This is, you know, bona fide stuff, that the origins of this campaign lie with CIA smuggling operations running into Eastern Europe. That's the origins of it. Okay, what else about the Palestinian solidarity campaign? Well, my understanding, I was going to go down to London. Well, so I say London, you know what I mean, to the centre of London yesterday. I couldn't quite raise the energy. I was going to go down to Marble Arch, this time not to march in solidarity with Gaza and the Palestinian cause, and yeah, join the chorus calling for an immediate Israeli ceasefire. No, I was going to go down to the Ukrainian solidarity demonstration that was going to go from Marble Arch to Trafalgar Square. Well, normally when I read the bourgeois media and they talk about hundreds marching, I greet it with a snort, especially when it concerns London, and especially when I've been on the demonstration and seen thousands and thousands of people march past me for hour after hour after hour, and not in single file or anything like that, but the whole street full of people. And they say thousands of people marched yesterday. Well, yeah, thousands did. But it wasn't even tens of thousands. It was hundreds of thousands. But this time the BBC announced that hundreds marched. What were their slogans? I don't know. But we were told in advance solidarity with Ukraine. And on the anniversary last year when they marched, yes, the chant was arm, arm, arm Ukraine. And so therefore they're lining up with Joe Biden and the Democrats in the United States, okay, against Donald Trump. That's how they will see it, but that's true. But they're also lining up with Rishi Sunak. They're lining up with King Charles the Third and the Great and the Good in Britain. They're joining their own ruling class in a war that I wouldn't describe as inter-imperialist, but I'm not, I can get into an argument or we can have a discussion about the nature of Russia. I don't think it's an imperialist power. I think it's reactionary power. I don't think we should support it. But the crucial question is the main enemy is at home. And for the social imperialists, people like the Ukraine Solidarity Campaign, people like Paul Mason, people like Peter Tatchell, and one can go on and on and on, the AWL, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. For them, the main enemy is in Moscow. The main enemy is in Beijing, not in London. For us, the main enemy is in London. These are the people that are imposing austerity. These are the people that are attacking our rights, our democratic rights that we've won against the capitalist class. And they ought to have the honesty, but of course they haven't got the honesty to admit that. They haven't got the honesty to admit that they're on the same side as Justin Trudeau, Georgina Milani, of Boris Johnson, who was over in Kiev yesterday, expressing their solidarity with Zelensky and his neoliberal right-wing soft on fascism regime. I wouldn't call it a fascist regime, but clearly, ideologically, it's soft on fascism. And clearly, people like the Azov Battalion, or is it the Brigade? I'm not quite sure. But the Azov movement is part of Zelensky's regime. Okay, moving on. I'll be very brief. What's the time? 42. So I'll try to finish by the hour. I think I can do that easily enough. Just wanted to mention the news that came in yesterday. I tried to look it up, tried to chase it, haven't found anything more worthwhile, including in the political report. But that's the last minute or last days of negotiations between Israel, the United States, Hamas, and various regional Arab governments over a ceasefire before Ramadan, March the 10th, before Israel is due to go on the ground offensive in Rafah. So there's talk, Hamas offer of a 6-month notice, Keir Starmer, not permanent ceasefire. No, that isn't actually what's being negotiated. No. Meanwhile, of course, we have not only last minute diplomacy going on to avoid what surely even from an American point of view, or maybe even especially from an American point of view, would be a disaster. Not by note in terms of their official statements, because 1 million people easily could die as a result of military assault, starvation and disease, but because of the strategic considerations in terms of the area. And I take that absolutely seriously. How stable is the regime in Cairo? How stable is the regime in Amman and Saudi Arabia? I would just answer, not stable at all. And if Palestinians start to die in their tens and tens and tens of thousands every day, I would expect there to be a huge movement on the so-called Arab street. That's why America is going in for intensive diplomatic activity. Meanwhile, we have a sort of idea of what sort of intentions Netanyahu has got from the plan that he's put to the war cabinet. So this isn't the plans of the war cabinet. This is Likud Netanyahu's plan for Gaza. And that includes Israeli domination of all the borders. So no Egyptian border with Gaza. It would now be an Israeli border. Israeli supervision of education, Israeli supervision of security, Israeli supervision, I would guess, of mosques. Who on earth would collaborate? And that's what the word we have to use. Who on earth would collaborate with that? I can't even see Fatah and the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, collaborating with that. Because one thing I'm certain of is if anyone did agree to participate as such a collaborator, they wouldn't need a price on their head from anybody to make them vulnerable, make them assert for assassination, whether by bullet or bomb or knife. They wouldn't last. That's what I'm certain of. So, okay, I'm not taking this as a serious Israeli plan because clearly it's going to be rejected by the mass of the Palestinians, but also by regional powers. Either way, what I take it as is Netanyahu stringing it out with both an object of keeping himself as prime minister, keeping himself out of jail, but also as Israel pushes ahead with its Nakba 2, with its expulsion plan of more Palestinians. What took us by surprise was October the 7th, of course, but the fact that it looks like the next round of mass expulsions wouldn't be from the West Bank, where they plan further and already got in through in terms of legislation, actual annexation. So, as well as East Jerusalem being annexed to Israel, there is legislation on the cards, on the book, so to speak, for other parts of the West Bank to be fully annexed by Israel. Instead, it looks like it's going to be Gaza and pushing people, forcing people to flee over the border into the into Egypt on the basis, well, maybe it's better to risk an Egyptian bullet that might not be fired than risk starvation and death by disease if we stay put. Either way, what Israel has in mind for the Palestinian people is, I think, a genocidal horror. And the fact that we have the United States, Britain, and other Western powers arming and excusing them says everything about the hypocrisy of the West, talking about human rights and democracy, while they actually, as I said, aid and abet one of the horrors, surely the biggest horror, if it happens in the 21st century. Showing the ideological shift that's going on in the West, just very briefly, we have not only Suella Braverman talking about Britain being dominated by Islamicists. We have Liz Truss over there jointly with Nigel Farage talking about the Islamic threat to Judeo-Christian civilization. Quite frankly, you could easily bolt onto that. I mean, these ideologies are picked up and made up and discarded when it's convenient. But of course, it was Jews, and not only from the Nazis and the Tsarists, Winston Churchill could be quoted saying that there was a Jewish plot to take over and dominate the West, conducted by Bolshevik Jews in communist parties, and they are combined with Jewish bankers, and how these two forces are plotting to bring down Christian civilization. Read it with Winston Churchill, 1926. You easily look it up. You'll be amazed in terms of his current saint-like figure, not only for the Tories, but also for the Labour Party and the Liberal Party, the establishment, the ruling class. But we also, of course, had Lee Anderson, who I think was on some radio station, isn't it? GB Talk or GB News? I don't know. Not my sort of listening, not my sort of watching. Either way, I think he corrected some interviewer when the interviewer was quoting Suella Braverman and said, well, no, Britain isn't dominated by Islamicists. London is. Sadiq Khan is dominated by Islamicists. And what do they mean by this? I'm not, I literally had to sort of take a step back and think, what is this twat going on about? And of course, what he's going on about is the demonstrations that I've been attending, the nine demonstrations in central London, that's calling for a ceasefire, that's got slogans, very widespread, from the river to the sea, down with apartheid Israel. All of that now, in terms of right-wing opinion, and so I'm including the Daily Mail, the Sun, certainly the Daily Telegraph, describe such slogans as anti-Semitic. So I keep quoting her, Tabitha Shapps, the daughter of the defense secretary up there in Leeds University. She couldn't take it when all her fellow students, I say all, many of her fellow students were describing Israel as an apartheid state. Daily Telegraph said this is an example of anti-Semitism. I say, well, if that's anti-Semitism, then the UN is anti-Semitic. Israel would agree. If the UN is anti-Semitic, also makes the US Human Rights Watch anti-Semitic. Israel would agree. Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite on that basis. Obviously, we know that South Africa is anti-Semitic. No, the definition is being moved. And anyone against Israel, anyone critical of Israel, is now being deemed as anti-Semitic. And then we have this leap, and therefore soft on Hamas and pro-Islamic. At least that's what I think is going on. That's how I interpret it. Okay, this has human consequences. So when Suella Braverman was Home Secretary and was agitating for the Metropolitan Police to ban the biggest demonstration, as it turned out, in the 21st century in London, the 800,000 strong demonstration. When she was agitating for that march to be banned, what did she actually produce? We've got to defend the cenotaph in Whitehall, the holy of holies when it comes to the wars of British imperialism. What she actually managed to mobilize was a right-wing mob. I saw it, in terms of being on the march in various pubs, but also a mob that actually ended up attacking the police in Whitehall around the cenotaph, making a huge din and noise, in the silence that was meant to commemorate the millions of war dead. Anderson, Braverman, Truss, this will have human consequences. In terms of mosques fire burnt, it will have consequences in terms of attacks on the streets. It will have consequences in terms of justifying chauvinist and violent chauvinist sentiment. Of that, I'm convinced. And of course, some of it won't be anything that Lee Anderson wants to associate himself with, but we have to recognize it. And we have to recognize that the rise of anti-Semitism is surely inevitable with the sort of horror that Israel is committing in the name of all Jewish people. Of course, it's a lie. All demonstrations that have happened in central London have been noticeable by the prominence of militantly anti-Zionist Jews, from the ultra-Orthodox religious to the anti-religious, and I do say anti-religious, secular. That's the spectrum that's been on these demonstrations. People want to identify themselves as Jews and saying this war, this regime has got nothing to do with us. So, of course, anti-Semitic incidents, we should expect them to have risen amongst ignorant people who take it out on people who are noticeably Jewish. Not that we support it, not that we defend it. Of course we don't. But we don't trust the Daily Telegraph to tell us what is anti-Semitic, and nor do I trust, what do they call it, the community, someone either in chat or the community service, but organisations like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. You know, Conway, what I'm thinking about. I don't trust them to define what is an anti-Semitic incident. But I do expect And that's what were reported. Again, I don't know whether the figures are scientifically accurate, but there were reports of anti-Muslim incidents increasing by 300%. As I said, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Okay, just a comment on further comment on Lee Anderson. Lee Anderson is noticeable not only for being a former Labourite, gone over to the extreme right of the Tory Party. Remember, only a short time ago, vice chair of the Tory Party. He's also on what the Tory Party calls the reform watch list. This is MPs that the Tory whips fear might defect to the Reform Party. And I think that's a distinct possibility. So we've got various ministers, various people appearing on the media at the moment, basically welcoming Lee Anderson back. He's been suspended, he's had a whip withdrawn. He's no longer a member of the Parliamentary Conservative Party. Some want him back, others want him gone. But maybe, this is pure speculation on my behalf. Maybe Lee Anderson is either a fool and just speaks what's on his mind. I don't know. I don't know him. Or maybe he's a very calculating politician, wants to get the whip withdrawn, and then says, okay, if you don't select me to stand as a Tory candidate, I'm going to stand as a Reform candidate in the forthcoming general election. I don't know the demographics. I don't know. The nature of his constituency, he will, Reform Party will, the Tory whips will, but at least that is a possibility. And we shouldn't discount the possibility of at least one Reform MP in the next Parliament. Just very quickly, 3 minutes officially, very brief. Maybe I'll just go over the hour. But Galloway, we're calling for a vote for Galloway. Yes, you can say hold your nose or whatever. To me, you're putting a cross on a piece of paper. Voting is a tactic, it's not a principle. Engels, back there in the 19th century, even speculated. Okay, it was a speculation or a mental game, but what about if the workers punish the Liberal Party who take working class votes for granted and we urge people to vote Tory? Well, that's not unprincipled. That's my point. Okay, so George Galloway, he's standing around issues of potholes, wages, conditions. But note, all of his election propaganda is done in the colours of the Palestinian flag. In reality, what's going on in Rochdale is a referendum about Palestine and Gaza. And on that basis, I cannot imagine voting for anyone else. Of course, you vote with criticisms. And so I agree with the comrades from SPIW, Socialist Party in England and Wales, who call for a vote for Galloway's what they call insurgent campaign. I have no hesitation myself in making such a call. I turn to Socialist Worker. And you would expect Socialist Worker to sort of in agreement with that. And it's no, we can't vote for George Galloway. Yeah, what he says on Palestine, that's fine. But what about what he says on women's rights? What about what he says about transsexuals? What about what he says on migration? What about his doubts around the climate question? We can't vote for him. And what we've had is a letter from comrade Ian Birchall, former leading comrade in the SWP in this week's paper, where he says we've got to vote instead for Mark Coleman. I'm sure he's a very nice guy, a vicar, someone whose campaign around Just Say No to Oil. But the difference is, comrade Birchall, is that George Galloway is the bookies' favourite. He's someone who could win. And I want myself, George Galloway, to get up in Parliament and to denounce not only the Tories and the government that's sending arms to Israel at this moment, but also to denounce Keir Starmer and the opposition and their mealy-mouth stuff about a permanent ceasefire. There's not going to be a permanent ceasefire. Their two-state solution, there's not going to be a two-state solution. But also denouncing, which I think he will do, the spineless Labour left who keep their mouth shut on this question, who don't dare say a word, who don't turn up to these huge demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine. And when they do, they guard every word that they say so that they don't suffer that terrible fate and get the whip withdrawn. He will denounce them in Parliament. We could find a situation of where they do everything to get rid of him. I can believe that. I don't know whether he would survive a general election. I don't know. But he's in with a very good chance. And at the moment, I think that would send a hugely positive message throughout Britain and indeed internationally. And as to the SWP, what I would say to them is, has George Galloway changed since he was leader of your Respect Party? I don't think so. Yes, it's true that he got into bed with the Harpal Brah son and daughter, the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist. Yeah, that's true. And they've written much of his program in terms of his Workers' Party and its praise for Cuba and the Soviet Union. But he was always of that view, right? Read his book. Wasn't it called? It was after the John Lennon song. Anyway, it was a quote from Imagine. I can't remember what particular quote it was. Either way, he describes the collapse of the Soviet Union as the worst day in his life. That should be enough for you, comrades in the SWP. But okay, SWP. So George Galloway hasn't changed his mind, in my view, at least since he led the Respect Party. But we were in Respect to throw bombs, or in George Galloway's words, because he knows a little bit of Lenin and a little bit of Marx, we were in Respect to support a man like a rope does, a hanged man. And we put motion after motion to Respect conferences. And not only had George Galloway putting up his hand to vote us down, we had the massed ranks, and it was massed ranks of the SWP voting us down. On what? A woman's right to choose. What? To have an abortion. The SWP rejected it. And what they replaced it with, and what the Mandelites propose, is a woman's right to choose to wear a veil. So, but a woman's right to choose whether to have an abortion, they voted it down. They voted down republicanism. Why? Because it would put off monarchists. That's the SWP talking. That's not George Galloway. That is the SWP. They voted down open borders. They did. The SWP voted it down. The SWP voted down its own proposition that you can find in Socialist Worker every week when it comes to socialism. They voted it down, not George Galloway, but you. And of course, what upset you about George Galloway is he knew more about South Asian origin politics. He knew more about the so-called Muslim community than the SWP and John Rees did. And the SWP split from Respect, claiming that it was being witch hunted. It wasn't being witch hunted. It was outvoted. And that was intolerable for the SWP. And the SWP hasn't forgiven George Galloway. Pathetic. Pathetic. How to run politics as if, you're dealing with petty personal differences. This isn't politics. It's pettiness. And what I'd say to the comrades in Spew is, okay, they're saying they support George Galloway. Indeed, they say that they were happy to have George Galloway and the Workers' Party in Tusk as observers. But they were voted down, not by a majority of their ruling committee, but they were voted down by the fact of the architecture that Spew had designed, whereby everything has to be done on consensus. And therefore, if you get one vote against the Workers' Party, you can't do anything. The Workers' Party cannot sit as an observer if one component part of Tusk objects. Well, imagine it in the Labour Party, that the British Socialist Party had a veto on the Labour Party supporting World War One. It could never happen. It wouldn't happen. But that's the nature of the Tusk project. It's a ridiculous project. Why on earth do you want a Labour Party Mark II that's even worse in terms of its architecture? We believe in democracy. Don't believe in vetoes. And that really brings me, thank you, Bob, to my last point, very closely related. I know I've run over to the comrades in the Spartacist League Britain, who's saying vote Tusk. We've got no problem looking at this constituency or that constituency, including wherever the Spartacist comrade stands. We would say, yeah, vote for a good old left winger, certainly in preference to a revolting Starmerite right winger. No hesitation in saying vote for it. As to actually standing ourselves, that's something we have to look to in terms of resources and the fact that we cannot stand because of the undemocratic laws in Britain under our own name. That is a consideration for us. But the Commies want to debate whether we should all affiliate to Tusk. Well, whether Spartacist League is accepted as an affiliate, I'd say is open to question, given that George Galloway's Workers' Party was turned down. But from our point of view, we don't accept that it's premature to argue for a Communist Party. We can't have a mass Communist Party tomorrow, but within 2024, we could have the nucleus of a Communist Party. And for us, we don't have a Labour Party or a reformist or a united front first stage to that. We could have that now. The Spartacist League, however few there are, us, however few there are. The RCP, as it's grandly called, the Ex-Socialist Appeal. But why not SPEW? Why not the SWP? Why can't these organizations unite as the left united, the principled internationalist left united in 1920 to form the CPGB? So, in terms of the challenge that the comrade who wrote to us this week in the Weekly Work, we say yes. Let's debate this. Let's have a debate. We are offering an online communist forum. We're offering two speakers each. We are used to democracy. We favor open debate. Let us debate it out. And so we would be saying, of course, we are prepared to participate in such organizations. We've got a history of doing it, we've got a history of standing candidates. In such organizations. But always, what marks us out is our struggle, our prioritization, doing what Lenin urged, getting hold of the main contradiction, the link, the main link in the change in the chain, and holding it, grasping it with both hands. And that link, of course, is a Communist Party, not a Labour Party Mark One, not a Labour Party Mark Two, not a reformist halfway house. But a full-blown nucleus of a Communist Party, mass Communist Party. This is for self-named, I would guess, Comrade Ant Evans, who doesn't believe that you can have a mass Communist Party before a revolutionary situation. My answer to you, Comrade Ant, is if you wait to build a mass Communist Party in the midst of a revolutionary situation, you're dead. You need one before, if you're going to have any chance of a revolution in a revolutionary situation.